you can live a full life. You can live like life to the full, you know, you can still be in awe of the way that the world just immediately presents itself to you.
Welcome to the Deadly Departed podcast, where the veil between the living and the dead is just a whisper away. I'm Jock, and along with my colleagues in Paranormal Daily News, we will be your guides through the shadowy realms of the paranormal and the unexplained. In each episode, we will dive into the eerie and the enigmatic with the help of today's leading experts in parapsychology, science, and the supernatural. Prepare to uncover the secrets that lurk in the dark and explore the mysteries that defy explanation. Let's embark on this journey now. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world. This is Jock here. This is Deadly Departed. I've tried going live with this. I've never done live. This is the Day of the Dead, and we decided to do a special episode, which if you're listening to this, it's going to probably be after Day of the Dead. Just imagine when you're listening, that's what it's going to be. My guest today is my colleague, Dr. Pascal Michael, who is also my research colleague for the academic work that I do as well. But we're going to dive into his work, his experiences, and basically where he's come from and where he's going. Dr. Pascal Michael is a lecturer at the University of Greenwich in London and is a psychonaut, actually. And I only found that out last night when I was watching some of his other things that he did, actually, because I didn't know that he had actually dove into psychedelics in a big way when he was studying as well. I didn't actually realize that. So, Dr. Pascal, welcome to Deadly Departed. How are you, my friend?
Yeah, thank you, Joe. Thanks for, us finally being able to be here, because we said that we were going to do it for a while, so that's cool. To be here with you, thank you. I'm good. I was at a Halloween event at the place where I live last night. Yeah, if anyone could see any remaining eyeliner and mascara, that's due to that.
Listen, that's all good fun. It would be boring if everybody did was the same. And I'm glad that you actually went to Halloween night. And I think it's very fitting, considering that this is the Day of the Dead. And, you know, I have a history, my early years, formative years, delving in seminary and monasteries and things like that. So the Day of the Dead to us is All Souls Day, where we pray for our loved ones going on. And actually, this is also my father's anniversary as well. So this is really a nice Day of the Dead. So it's an event that's in many cultures over the world, indigenous cultures as well. And so this is kind of fitting. But I want to dive into not your Day of the Dead as such, but you know, your interest, because you're well known. I mean, you were literally unknown, and then all of a sudden you became more known. You ended up at Contact in the Desert, and you had some great lectures that are online regarding your work with psychedelics. And I don't profess to be anywhere near an expert at anything this. So I get from one of your interviews that you were doing, you had mentioned that your upbringing was more of a kind of spiritual type upbringing. And so tell us a little bit about where you got your interest from before you went to university and became an expert in this field.
Well, about my upbringing, as you mentioned, I mean, my mother was, maybe this was what you heard in the interview, that she was, as I was growing up, she was rather what you would call a bit, you know, like new age. She was very much into the esoteric things. And so I was always, you know, brought up around that, engaging, you know, these kind of conversations when I was very young, you know, that clearly opened my mind in an instrumental way, you know, in those formative years and stuff. But then my dad was on the kind of other end of the spectrum, and he was like quite a traditional, like Greek Cypriot Orthodox. And so I kind of, I got the best of both worlds in a way, and quite, you know, polar extremes in some manner, but both still embracing, you know, obviously in a different manner, of something, you know, beyond the purely material. But, you know, that's not to say that my dad was also really instrumental in my interest in the sciences, because there was always a kind of a peculiar thing with him where he was very, very passionate about the concept, the idea of God in a quite eschatological kind of way. He would always, idea of the kingdom of God, for instance, was very like close to his heart, and we discussed that a lot, kind of theologically. But despite that, like, he was quite emphatic about the necessity of evidence about not about Christianity. He had his own faith in that. That was very much more of a heart thing, which was also very critical for me to be brought up around. But he had a bit of a juxtaposed, like, yeah, interest in evidence for things like what my mum would be talking about, of a more parapsychological nature or whatever, or what I ended up studying. Yeah, and then, but he himself had interesting experiences, and I think, like, kind of maybe chief amongst which was these sort of precognitive dreams. So he was quite convinced about them, and so was obviously interested in the kind of possible, like, illusory nature of time. And yeah, but then I had my own precognitive dream experiences as well from a young age, and that was probably the first of these experiences which made, you know, open my mind in a more direct experiential way to these kinds of things. And then doing my own research, just reading books about, you know, again, largely things which my parents would have given me, like my mum, for instance, and Michael Talbot, The Holographic Universe, and Bruce Lipton, like, what's The Biology of Belief. But then I started to read her, like, near-death experience books, and that especially captivated me. And I think, yeah, as much as these other books and things that I'd be reading in her library were captivating, there's something about near-death experiences which seemed a bit more evidential in some way. But, you know, not only were they really inspiring glimpses into, like, you know, apertures into, like, a potentially much vaster universe, including that which we are embedded within in our individual lives, and it may reflect something about the a larger existence beyond this particular life, and like after death. And they were also quite amenable to, like, neuroscience. And so ultimately, that's one reason why I wanted to do a neuroscience degree.
I find that fascinating. So your interest in near-death experiences actually gave you the push to go and study neuroscience.
Yeah, I'd say that was...
And then you collated that between your psychedelic work. I think that's... We'll get into that a little bit later, but I find that fascinating that you went to study the brain because of near-death experience. That's very unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it struck me that obviously these near-death experiences, you can't unmarry them from the body and nervous system, you know, because ultimately the initial trigger is whatever it is, whatever cardiac arrest, bodily trauma, it all ultimately ends up in anoxia to the brain, right? No, to the brain. And so while ultimately it may look like this entirely transcendent non-material phenomenon, like, you can't escape the fact that the original conditions are completely rooted in the brain, and so there has to be some fundamentally important relationship therein. Yeah, and the psychedelic thing came relatively soon after that, in the later years of my undergrad. And then, but I don't think I wouldn't necessarily call myself a psychonaut. Maybe at the time I was like a budding psychonaut, and, you know, I did get into, okay, it's a subjective term as to what, you know, how you define it, but I did get into a lot of very deep and complex and challenging, rather mad altered states of consciousness a lot. But in terms of, like, this sort of psychonautics of taking, like, massive doses of psychedelics, like classical psychedelics, like psilocybin or DMT or whatever, like, regularly, you know, and in a way where you can really sustain it and just navigate those completely far out landscapes of consciousness. Like, I never really got there, because I kind of realized quite early on that my, like, neurological, like, psychological constitution just wasn't that. And, you know, that was a responsible decision for me to make.
So let me ask you a challenging question, which I find something that you say. So you have mentioned that the near-death experiences that you have studied and you have done a lot of research into, you perceive, if you will, that it's rooted in the brain. So where do you then coalesce people that have a transcendent experience that might even be evidential in its nature? Do you think that still comes from the brain, therefore looking at it from a materialist perspective, or are you able to accept, or I don't know, maybe consider that the brain is merely the receiver? Where do you stand there?
I am always asked that, and you know, I still don't know what other answer to give.
Sorry.
Other than, no, it's obviously, it's like, yeah, it's a natural question. But there is a lot of data that people who, I don't know, either people who are, you know, fair enough, they're not as engaged in the literature, like, or they certainly have the opportunities to be, but they don't look at it. Like, they would be, they would be surprised to find out, you know, that there is a lot in the scientific literature about the neural correlates of the near-death experience, and that may be, or dying generally, you know, that may be rodent models, chemical level, what's going in the brain on a neuroelectric level, what's going on with EEG, you know, as these rats might die, or human beings rigged to like more simplistic EEG, like the frontal cortex, when they're being taken off life support, or even more recently, some more cases of like full EEG data coming from human beings who have also passed away. And so, you know, there's a lot of neurological data now, and there's a lot of activity in the brain, basically. Lots of neurotransmitters, serotonin.
So this also brings up the fundamental question, which is a question that is confounding researchers and has done for probably hundreds of years, but this nature of consciousness. And I kind of refer back to split brain examples and Ian McGilchrist's work, where consciousness seemed to still exist and had efficacy, had evidence, even when the brain was apparently dead. So therefore, a lot of what you're saying, yeah, I can accept that. I can accept that there is neurocorrelates. There's a pattern there that exists. But there also seems to be that the brain is also not needed for these experiences. And whether it's from a psychedelic, which we'll jump into, or a near-death experience, I mean, this is not my interview, but it's all about you. Having my own near-death experience and crossing over is so real.
Yeah.
That it makes you wanna kind of keep chasing it. But then this evidence of consciousness, where it comes from, or do we continue after the body gives up, the brain gives up? And we have examples of it. We do have examples of conscious experience after the brain has gone. And I think the work of Dr. Parnham and near-death experiences, and many others, I can't remember her name now, other books where the evidence is strong, where the brain has closed, but there's consciousness, yeah, and there's evidence. How do you...
Well, because, you know, as I say, there's all this activity. And so it's really a matter of, we don't really know exactly when the near-death experience actually occurred, because you have basically a timeline of the brain where it goes, experiences lack of oxygen, and then its activity starts to decline, and then it gets to a kind of like a critical kind of threshold thing where suddenly it has this deluge of different neurotransmitters, has this very high frequency and like gamma wave like activity, etc., etc. And then, you know, if the person like ensues to die, you know, in the technical definition of the term, it's irreversible death, then ultimately it will like go down to like this like delta wave, like the lowest wave possible, and then obviously you're a flat line. But within, and so obviously with people who have near-death experiences, they'll revive, and you know, and their heart may have stopped, so their brain may have experienced this whole pattern, this whole timeline, obviously, mm-hmm, other than post you know, this end of this critical threshold thing where it goes to slow wave and then flatline, right? So it will go through that whole process beforehand. And so theoretically, the near-death experience that they report could be owing to their brain going into enough of that phase in which there is this suddenly elevated activity on these different levels, right? The thing is that we still don't know the exact temporal correlation of DMD. Like, we don't know when it occurs. Like, so people before this burgeoning evidence, which actually started to come out like quite a while ago, like early 2000s and stuff. And it was all about this idea of the paradox of the what near death experiences present. It's like the brain's like flatlined, but they're still having these experiences. That was before all this burgeoning evidence. So now, you know, people who are very neurologically minded or, you know, reductionist will simply say it's obviously just due to all of this higher activity. I'm not necessarily saying that. I'm just saying that has to be included in the equation. Otherwise, you're just, you know, it's just information bias. But the thing is that now it's the question of when the NDE occurred. Did it occur when the brain, like, was not experiencing this high level activity, or when it was? And if it was the former, then that's obviously more interesting, because it shouldn't be able to produce all this very, very lucid, elaborate, you know, rich, profound, transcendent experience.
If you are enjoying this episode of Deadly Departed, then please share it with your colleagues or share it with your friends. And if you've got any ideas on anyone that you would like us to invite onto the podcast for an interview, then please let us know. Once again, thank you for joining us today. And please remember and subscribe. God bless. Now, you worked with... This is where my interest lies as well, because the work that you did with Dr. David Luke at university as well, you were involved in a research project that looked at the correlation between the near-death experience and the use of these psychedelics. Now, what I'm interested in to find out from you is, when people were using these psychedelics, were the near-death experiences pretty much the same in terms of context and structure, or were they uniquely different?
I can obviously say lots of that, but I know, you know, you're interviewing me, but it would be interesting fresh from like a initial appraisal thing from your perspective. What would you like say? Because then I can bounce off that in terms of my answer.
All right. Okay. Right. So I'm switching roles. So from my perspective, I don't have any psychedelic experience, right? Other than, you know, back in my youth days, I was probably so, when I was in the military, I got so drunk that I couldn't remember where I was and we started to see things.
You're kind of familiar with this, when I had other people's psychedelic experiences, or like people telling you, or the literature or something, right?
I've spoke to people that have had psychedelic, you know, when I had a near-death experience, it was in a bad car accident. My wife and I shouldn't be here. It was really, really bad. And I had the experience where time stood still, bright light, and then I was kind of over another end. I didn't meet any wonderful beings that taught me so many things, but I knew that I had loved ones there, and I knew there was a higher force that was, because I heard instructions, I heard voices and things like that. So I knew that I was more. I knew there was an interconnectedness to everything, and almost could see everything, could be a part of everything. And then eventually, you know, when I came back, I always tried to... There's a sadness to it. There's a sadness to any near-death, I think. There's a sadness to any near-death experience, because you come back and you want to capture that experience again, because it's so primordial, it's so part of you. It feels so real. It feels that that is what it should be. And then you come to the material world and you try to replicate it, and you can't replicate it. No matter how much, I've been a professional medium for over 2 decades. I've had many, many, many experiences in all sorts of things with various phenomena. And my journey, even to this day, trying to replicate that same feeling that I had when I had that NDE, has been a failure. And so no matter how much meditation I do, how much try to, even if you like, remote view the other side or whatever it is, I cannot get that same feeling. So it kind of puts you into a little bit of a negative spiral where you feel disconnected from it, which brought me into the interest then of the psychedelic experience. Now, I've never taken anything yet. That's not to say that won't happen, because I am very interested to find out, even from a medium's point of view, whether there's a difference in that. Right. But then I've spoken to people who have taken it, and I've had everything from they met their loved ones, or they met a being, or even an alien type phenomena. And then they had these mystical experiences that kind of changed their whole view, an ontological shift of everything, which is something that, you know, we're discussing in our research. But there's been lack of evidence for me. Everybody I've spoke to, for me, there's been a lack of, and for me, everything's about the evidence.
What would the evidence difference be in terms of yours or near-death experiences generally, and then psychedelics? What's evidential about NDEs?
If someone can come, so for instance, when you do look a lot into research with NDEs, there's been examples where the person who had left their body was able to identify, was on a roof, was able to identify a coin that was on a shelf, and or there has been connections where they've had loved ones that have given them verifiable evidence that had to be corroborated later, could not be corroborated there and then, right? So now you have something where maybe somebody would say it's super psi, they could, you know, maybe that's how they're connecting, getting the evidence of what they see or what they view. But then you've got people that come back, have got the evidence from particular connection with loved ones that they have, it has to be corroborated later. And so I haven't met anybody that has taken a psychedelic experience that's come back and said, hey, I met my great aunt Fanny who, you know, told me this and I had to research it and it became true. Now, here's the other thing that really intrigues me. The greatest, even as me as a medium, the greatest example of continuing consciousness after death for me has to be past life research, which I used to be past lives. Right? Because I used to be incredibly skeptical about it, right? And then I wrote a book about it many, many years ago. And it kind of changed my direction and what I felt. And now when you look at a lot of these cases where the evidence is astounding and they're identifying past lives. So that's, and to the point of addresses, names, places, you know, whole genealogy, that's fascinating. That to me says that there's something else that we need to know. You know, I'm not going to say it's 100% everything is right, because I always say it warrants further investigation. Even as my work as a medium is, like, I'll never say this is 100% the way it is. You know, I can say that I know something. I very rarely ever say that I believe something. I try to also say I know something from my soul. But I'll always maintain this warrants further investigation. And this is where I can see where we go with the near-death experience, psychedelics, afterlife research, mediumship as well, and the continuation of consciousness by past lives. And so, but anybody that I've spoke to, and I'm hoping, even in the grief research that we're doing between, you know, ontological shock and psychedelics and grief, the journey, integration, I'm hoping that there will be some correlation to psychedelic experiences that have an evidential nature.
Yeah.
I don't seem to see that now.
Yeah, I mean, naturally, you know, there are these components of near-death experiences that people get especially excited about. Really cool out-of-body experiences, like you mentioned, so-called peak in Darien experiences where you see people who, you know, in your near-death experience, who you never even knew or didn't know that they were dead at the time, and that's corroborated afterward. Or even the blind, there are studies of people who are even congenitally blind and having not just near-death experiences in terms of all the other kind of features of it, but, you know, they're quite convinced that they are of a visual nature, even though they've never experienced light before. So, you know, it's all interesting, but why I ask that is because it's just the standard of evidence that, like, scientists, in order to say that there is, like, really considerable supporting evidence for it, like, if it's high, right? So with psychedelics, there are plenty of the, like, corresponding things. There's not much systematic research in terms of, like, these really quite odd experiences or the peak in Darien thing or even in the blind, but myself and or David Luke have been looking into that in some respects, and the research that we were doing with DMT before my PhD, what that was, a like a psychedelic parapsychological or like
just explain to people. Sorry, just explain to people who maybe are listening don't know what DMT is.
Yeah. It's just a
explain what it is.
A classical psychedelic, like magic, the same compound that's in magic mushrooms. It's a very similar compound to that, and it's the kind of main ingredient responsible for the psychedelic visions in ayahuasca, this Amazonian shamanic brew. So yeah, I mean, the thing is that indigenously it's been used for this kind of divination purposes, right? Mm. So this is just like contemporary parapsychological methodology to like do similar things. And you know, we found that it's complicated in terms of the final analysis, but basically the people on DMT compared to the control condition were much more likely to correctly, it's not so simple as like correctly slate peered into the future, but they were more likely to have a kind of vision which corresponded to one of a series of videos that we would then show them directly after their experience, basically. So you know, so there's that.
I find that fascinating.
That's not just anecdotal evidentiality, you know, psychedelics. That's a scientific method. It, you know, well, like all scientific studies, it obviously has its limitations. But that's obviously interesting. And just lastly, in terms of these like correspondences, yeah, I'm wanting to do a study on critical ABs with psychedelics. I have several people that I've already contacted who have had these peak Indarian things with psychedelics, for instance, like being on acid, and their grandmother passed away during those 6 hours or whatever without them knowing, obviously, and they had this whole encounter and apparition of their grandmother, which was obviously corroborated directly afterward. We actually did do sort of a small scale study with some people who were blind, like congenitally blind, and had other altered states, but a couple of them had psychedelics. One of them had a high dose mushroom experience, and they, you know, it's obviously very, this stuff isn't really in this qualitative manner. It's not something that you can prove, but the way that the narrative's like read, or this guy's account, you know, how it sounded was very comparable to the blind near death experiences, and being like very astonished as to the sensory experience that they're having in this altered state, being someone that's been blind their whole life.
Does it have the same structure as a normal near-death experience, where they see the bright light, they feel connected to everything, the auditory senses and visual? I mean, or is it different? Could you take one near-death experience without a psychedelics, say, for instance, mine or somebody else's, and say, yeah, that's the same kind of structure they went through, the tunnel or anything like that?
Not really. Yeah, that is what's pretty interesting about the near-death experiences, is that they are actually pretty reliable in terms of their repeated structure. I mean, not necessarily like temporally. There's a couple of like competing papers on that. Like one is quite emphatic that there is no, the only temporal structure is actually really narrow. Like a decent proportion of near-death experiences are likely to like feel a sense of peace, have an out-of-body experience, and then like see a light or go through a tunnel, can't remember which, and then obviously have some experience of coming back, obviously. So it's interesting that aligns with the most common experiences, and the most common experiences are usually going to be the shallower, because the deeper ones are going to be a bit rarer. So amongst the more common and less like really deep ones, there tends to be this simple like order. And you could argue that is actually something that you can quite easily map on to like a breakthrough DMT experience, for instance, that you do get a sudden like body rush, and it might be like the sense of euphoria, but then you become disembodied very quickly and you can't even feel your body any longer, and you have this sense of like rushing through some like non-conventional space, then you might perforate something and you find yourself in an entirely different landscape. And it's going to be extremely vibrant and colorful, you know, and bright. And then you'll have a return experience of like reassembling and like reintegrating back into your body. So, you know, those very basic layers around which everything else will be built, you know, the basic most layers are pretty much the same.
You know, maybe it also, I mean, there's so many things I want to go down, and I want to jump into perhaps the negative experiences, and also I'm thinking as well of the cross correspondence, where you're talking about maybe research, the cross correspondences, as you know, that have been reported widely in SPR from back in the day where they were able to, at a distance, be able to corroborate, identify evidence, maybe in a book or something from one end of the country to the other, but a little bit like kind of remote viewing. And I'm wondering if there's a potential in research with psychedelics to be able to do something like that, where you can... I find it fascinating that you've corroborated some evidence where they had some element of precognition, where they could potentially, you know, tell or feel the future, according to Daryl Bem. You feel the future there. So I wonder if there's a potential research into elements like cross correspondences from way back in the day, where you could take subjects and get them to get information from a target, almost like remote viewing, but utilizing the psychedelic. And also another thing I want to talk about is that also what you're explaining, is it a near-death experience that people that are having this psychedelic experience, or is it an out-of-body experience and not near-death?
What do you mean? Are people who are having these kinds of psychedelic experiences having more like OBEs rather than NDEs?
More like an OBE than an NDE.
I mean, yeah, you could argue that in a way. Like, if you mean that kind of OBE, which is more like a kind of astral projection-y kind of thing, you know, because they're obviously being disembodied, they're going into another space, and they're, like, traversing that, and it's all very celestial and stuff. And obviously, they're in a context where they're not actually near death. So, you know, it's a kind of a fair comparison. It's just OBEs, in a way, OBEs don't follow such an obvious structure, and DMT doesn't really either, other than, you know, this like more generic structure that I mentioned, whereas near-death experiences do seem to be more structural and maybe sequential in a way. So maybe they're a bit different in that respect, and the why NDEs might be like that is because I do think that a lot of it, you know, maybe not all of it, but a lot of it is kind of neurologically determined, so that there may be like time signatures involved within that, like different recruitments of different like neural activity and stuff at different times. So yeah, maybe OBEs is an interesting comparison. I just was not really that interested in OBEs. I was interested in NDEs, you know, because it's we're talking about death, you know, and that is nothing more intimate, you know, than that.
But I know you're not interested in it, but I think a lot of people that would claim they have an NDE are essentially having an OBE. And maybe even the data that you get from people having NDE experiences is their non-evidential aspect of it is possibly maybe it's just an OBE that they're experiencing.
Well, I mean, because, yeah, there's this, you can delineate them quite, like, because the near-death experience is something, like a classical near-death experience is when they're actually in a context of the near-death, you know, they've got some threat to life, and that could be on a psychological level, but there's still like a potential genuine threat to life as far as they perceive it, or whatever, they're in some physiological condition, whereas that's obviously not the case with this broadest term of what OBEs are, right? They're just happy, whatever, you can induce them, you know, around sleep or spontaneous or whatever. Yeah, and but also just definitions wise, from someone that's steeped in NDE research, I guess, like me, like whenever I think of the OBE, that's just one component of the near-death experience when they first come out of their body and they might see themselves before they have this subsequent more like transcendence phase where they not only leave their body but they then like leave this terrestrial space. And so yeah, it just becomes like a semantic thing, like I guess like the OBE that you're referring to is can potentially incorporate all of that, right? Then seeing themselves and or going beyond. It's just the context which is the most distinguishing factor.
Do you think there's a correlation to terminal lucidity and the NDE?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the terminal lucidity can quite directly map on to this idea that I was saying about near-death experiences maybe being importantly contributed to by some terminal activity, like in the brain. You know, because a lot of these, your body's getting to this critical point, and so your body like starts to recruit all of these like sudden adaptive, like mechanisms for neuroprotection's sake. Yeah, so if there's particular neurotransmitters released for that purpose, then that could happen in a very acute and dramatic way, like when the heart stops beating, and then this whole process I mentioned before happens in the brain. But a similar principle may be happening with terminal lucidity, just not at that point. You know, it's a it's a kind of a precursor and a more like protracted thing where a person is like in bed or whatever and they're on their way out, but it's not like they've had a sudden cardiac arrest or whatever, and the nervous system is still slowly preparing for that experience. And it could account for, because for instance, I'm not saying this is a direct, you know, we have no direct evidence for this.
If you're fascinated by the mysteries of the afterlife, consciousness and the unexplained, you're in the right place. Through Deadly Departed, Paranormal Daily News and the Parawise Journal, I explore the paranormal from every angle. Investigative reporting, expert conversations, and of course, serious academic research. We also publish books and support new writers. We now host the PDN Book Awards and have a private inner circle community where people can continue the conversation beyond this podcast. If you want to go deeper, visit paranormaldailynews.com and explore our PDN network.
I'm not saying it's a one-to-one analogy, but there is, if endogenous psychedelic-like compounds are released in the body, then what they do is they increase entropy in the brain. And that is just kind of unpredictable patterns of activity in the brain. But that may seem like chaos, but what that does actually index is like the richness of phenomenal conscious experience. So that can account for like mystical kind of states and stuff with the actual like acute near-death experience, potentially. Certainly the mystical experience stuff in high-dose psychedelic experiences, you know. So if we're talking about terminal lucidity, where before they're in a very low conscious state, and suddenly they have this like window of being able to be alert or something, being able to connect, etc., for however transiently it is, it could be a similar process there going on, like where the entropy of the brain is being like adaptively modulated and stuff. And you know, they're even doing trials of psychedelic ketamine, psilocybin for people in coma to precipitate exactly the same response.
Do you think Pascal, that the brain, there's a great kind of belief or acceptance, certainly from me and from people in my side of things, that we feel that the brain is a receiver and acts as a receiver and then transmits through the body to physiology, the biology, etc. Maybe that we can reverse it, and the brain, as you're explaining it, can also be the transmitter to the mind function, and maybe the experience is transmitting, and therefore the experience is still beyond the brain.
Yeah, I'm very, very open to that. You know, it always sounds like I'm a reductionist when I talk about other neuroscience, but I'm not.
No,
I'm just an inclusionist. You know, I just want to include all of the neuroscience as possible, while also being
I think it's great.
Because ultimately it is hubris. I get it though. You know, like scientists have a really unbelievably admirable grasp of the natural world, right? And so you can, even unconsciously, you can become quite hubristic about, I know what the world consists of and how it works. And so you might be given, you know, you might be vulnerable to reductionism and, you know, not entertaining something beyond the brain, like when considering these kinds of experiences. But it is premature, and there is a level of kind of closed-mindedness or arrogance. Not amongst all scientists. I know plenty of scientists that all they want is data. They're literally, they're like, is that like me? Like they're completely open to it.
Yeah.
It's not actually that they have some narrow-minded a priori negation of it. It's actually just that fair enough, that there isn't compelling enough evidence of a nature that will convince them, that lies in the hierarchy of evidence that is needed for a potential, you know, rewriting or, you know, upheaval of all the models that we've got so far, right? So there's a lot riding on it, but despite, you know, and I'm very interested about psychological predispositions that certain neuroscientists or neuroscientists might have against wanting to be, you know, more sympathetic to these kind of things, because it can be, it's not just institutionally or professionally, it's like ontologically very challenging. But I still think that there are plenty of scientists that don't have any of those hang-ups And actually, if they were given, you know, some of them were even doing these studies that I know, you know, if they were given that data from theirs or other labs, then they'll be, they're like scientists, right? They'll just have to keep repeating the experiment over and over with different modifications and furthering that line of inquiry until they'll first really scratch their chin and then they'll be blown away. But if that line of inquiry does continue to be fruitful, some of them will be embracing of it and accepting of it. And we also always see this in the circuit of scientists that talk about these spiritual kind of phenomena, you know, the whole spiritual science kind of subcommunity of researchers and speakers and whatever. They've kind of already been through that. And so they're kind of on the other side of it, but everyone's different in terms of the quality of evidence that they're going to need. And, you know, and that could be personal experiences as well. And for them, that's sort of enough. But for a third party, it's not necessarily.
Absolutely. I think I've always said that every man's failure is another man's evidence, or every man's evidence is another man's failure. That kind of boils down to that. If you are enjoying this episode of Deadly Departed, then please share it with your colleagues or share it with your friends. And if you've got any ideas on anyone that you would like us to invite onto the podcast for an interview, then please let us know. Once again, thank you for joining us today. And please remember and subscribe. God bless. I want to kind of, the way that we're talking is that all these experiences, something that we're interested in, that we're doing some research on together, is ontological shock and a spiritual awakening, ontological shift as well. As we talk about these experiences, the near-death experiences, I mentioned that there's an element to it that can cause some, not psychosis, but can cause some mental imbalance where you're always searching for it. Not every experience with DMT, psilocybin, anything else can be positive. There must be, I want to kind of go into the dangers of it, where have you come across people that have had negative experiences? And that may mean as well is meeting other beings or other intelligences when they're having the experience. And how does it affect their worldview when they come back if it's a negative thing that they're experiencing? Because what we are talking about is people having these wonderful, you know, NDE experiences and something that shifts and they have this vibrancy, and can't always be rainbows and buttercups over there, if you know what I mean.
You can talk about the near-death experience thread or the psychedelic thread, like the near-death experience, like with 14% of them or so, you know, the later papers are of this distressing nature. You know, that's just a word, distressing. Like when you actually read some of them, yeah, they're kind of like categorized. It's weird. Right. Like, there's been two papers, one in the 90s and then one like in the last 10 years or so. And the three major categories of these distressing near-death experiences are basically the same, which is, again, it speaks to what I was saying before about the kind of almost uncanny repeatability of these NDEs. You would have a near-death experience that's kind of like any other near-death experience in terms of the features and stuff, but they're interpreted emotionally and like ontologically, whatever, in a very, very different way. Or existentially rather more than ontologically, that they'll be experienced as just very, very frightening. And that'll be, you know, for different reasons for those people. Or you'll have void type experiences where a person kind of experiences like non-existence in some sort of paradoxical way. You know, it's a sense of like nothingness and emptiness. And that might involve a sense of like meaninglessness on a more existential level.
Yeah, I can see that. If you're hoping there's something on the other side and you go into this whole nothingness,
yeah,
that could cause a little bit of shock.
And then like quite like standard, like from a historical perspective, like hellscapes, you know, quite like pastiche, almost medieval Dante's Inferno type stuff. So you read the descriptions, but to have the experience can be really like obliterating of your, you know, your ongoing experience after it. So it's not the funnest of stuff to talk about ultimately, is it? Like for them, so it maybe even be a presentation or for people to communicate about. So there's been an overemphasis on the positive ones, but there really is it's a difficult thing to to reconcile, even to accept, you know, on a grander scale of things, looking at it like that these some people can, I mean, basically it's over a macrocosmic experience of like life. You know, some people have some, you know, grace and blessed experiences in life or death or near death in this case, and other people have they have really hard luck and they have traumatic experience and it's tragedy. And this is the idea of just fate, for whatever reason. Some people have these completely polarized experiences. And so with, you know, and it's interesting to see why, you know, I say fate, but I say that in a looser fashion. I mean, there hasn't been really systematic research on predictors of these so-called distressing near-death experiences. Like, why? It's certainly not because these were bad people. You know, that's a very silly, like, superficial phrase of what it might be. It's my interpretation. I mean, in a way, you know, I'm just preempting whatever research there might be on it, but it would be very, you know, segueing to the psychedelic stuff. There is now quite a lot of burgeoning research into the predictors of what in that literature is that referred to as challenging psychedelic experiences. And, you know, these would be things like having past experiences of trauma or scoring very highly on neuroticism, like having kind of like an anxious personality. Certain, like if you're given to, like, if you've got a history or a family history of like schizophrenia or things like that, having psychedelic experiences which are challenging might be more predicted by like having borderline personality in your past and things. So it may be because of mine and other people's research on the legitimate comparability between NDEs and psychedelics. Obviously they're certainly not just a one-to-one relationship, but because of that, I'm sure that there's going to be similar signals in terms of difficult NDEs as well.
Are we inducing an NDE? Are we deliberately inducing the NDE experience by dabbling with psychedelics?
Well, yeah. I mean, like with ketamine, for instance, John Lilly referred to it as something like adventures in experimental death, you know. So this kind of, and they're considered like it's good experimental models of near-death experiences, like especially DMT and ketamine, actually. That's one obvious difference, is that you're doing something yourself in order to have this kind of experience rather than it just happen to you when you do ultimately kick the bucket. But obviously that's something which has been recognized since, you know, God knows how long back. Like, this is something that you can say that is something that indigenous cultures do. If they use these entheogens or these psychedelics, they use them for this purpose of having a death, rebirth experience. And, you know, there may be, you know, in antiquity, there may be similar things going on with certain mystery cults taking certain concoctions, you know, if it's like spiked wine with the Dionysian mysteries, or potentially some psychoactive concoction with the Greek Eleusinian mysteries. There's a lot of like debate there as to what it could be. They certainly incorporated a drink, but whether it was that directly or it was the entire context, which was ritually and elaborately like curated around that, and all the preparations that these people made beforehand for months, and this kind of psychological sort of priming for this kind of experience and whatever, you know, maybe that's sufficient. Maybe it was like a placebo type thing in the drink itself. Like, maybe it was a ritual drink for something psychoactive. Yeah. You know, who knows?
I think I read somewhere, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know if this comes from obviously your Greek heritage, but didn't the Delphi Oracle or the Oracle of Delphi, didn't she take a psychoactive concoction before she actually did divination?
I don't fully know. There's going to be lots of different conversations on that, I'm sure. But there's certainly some thread about the location of Delphi and the real possibility of like gases, you know, maybe being deliberately like funneled through into the Delphic oracular chamber.
So do you think then, now with all the research you've done with the NDE, and this is something that you and I are interested in as well, and the use of psychedelics, that there is a strong therapeutic potential to this, to helping people through grief, on the grief journey? And also, you mentioned and I'm kind of fascinated with this as well, the schizophrenia side of things. Like, we have a mental health component where we can perhaps look at psychedelic or even inducing a near-death experience to cope with an imbalance such as schizophrenia, which I am of the opinion is 90% a spiritual problem and not really a brain problem. But that, again, that's my opinion.
Well, the psychedelics for the schizophrenia thing, there's some, you know, the psychedelic renaissance, as it's been called, was treading on eggshells to start, and then it started to just, you know, just be a bit more careful, you know, because the landscape was still a bit precarious while it was still growing. So, you know, they were focusing on less risky indications, you know, like intractable depression, you know, things which there was more urgency around because of the lack of responsive medication and stuff like that. But yeah, there's a bit more research, like there's survey research and there's some like narrative reviews about how psychedelics could be useful for that. And so people who have diagnosis of some psychotic condition and they take psychedelics themselves and what their experiences are. But obviously, you know, that's obviously a bit of a biased sample because these are people that are really taking it and they're not going to, presumably they're not on the whole going to be keep taking it if it's really bad for you. That's not to say that that might not happen. I have heard at least one case of someone continuing to exacerbate their psychosis with high dose mushroom. So they report that it can be helpful for self-medication in some regards. Like they'll have a bit more insight, you know, so they'll, in a clinical definition, that's to say that they can discern what is reality and what isn't a bit better. And that's, you know, a hallmark feature of schizophrenia. You lose that insight. You can't distinguish what's fantasy and reality in terms of your hallucinations and delusions and so-called like consensus reality, at least. So that's interesting. You know, the differences in altered states that they'll experience between the trip and their psychosis might be helpful in discerning that for these people, at least. Yeah, some other things, can't remember now, but it's interesting preliminary data. There's schizophrenia is obviously very complicated. There's different phases and dimensions to it, right? So they can help with the negative symptoms for sure, because those map quite a lot onto like depression symptoms and, you know, being very withdrawn, like no motivation or pleasure. You know, it can even be like, you know, catatonic kind of stuff. So psychedelics can be really helpful for that, certainly. But it's not depression, it's schizophrenia. So in helping with that, you may elicit psychotic type symptoms, and that's very similar to things we see with bipolar disorder. Like psychedelics are very useful for unipolar depression, but if you were to treat someone with bipolar psychedelics, it could induce manic symptoms. Again, there is a bit more research into that, and that's not necessarily universally going to be a complication, but it will be for some. So that's the problem, obviously. Like with some people, they're going to respond very well, and it's not going to induce psychotic or manic symptoms. And for some, it'll be the very worst thing for them. So, yeah, I mean, there was a recent paper I saw about MDMA for schizophrenia, so that may help with the negative symptoms while not being so dangerous in terms of maybe eliciting psychotic symptoms, you know, things like that. And it would help with like social cognition and empathy and stuff, which can get eroded with schizophrenia and stuff. And also, importantly, both MDMA and especially these other psychedelics are very neuroplastic. You know, they're like psychoplastogens, so they help the brain to form new synaptic connections and things, and potentially create new neurons. And schizophrenia is, you know, chronically can end up being like a neurodegenerative thing. But you do see loss of cortical, like gray matter and stuff. So the thing is that the trip is the potentially jeopardizing part of this for these people. So there are these new compounds being produced which are based on psychedelics but have kind of pruned out the trip inducing part of it by modulating the chemical, so they still induce neuroplasticity without the trip. So I think that I'm personally super excited about the continued development of them, because that's going to be a potential game changer for neurological diseases, but also for neuropsychiatric conditions where there's a risk with the trip.
Can it help? So look, we've gone over time what we normally do. Are you all right to carry on? Because I think this is fascinating. Can it help with helping our brain, right? Because I was coming from a neuroscientific point of view, helping our brain get healthier, or even to develop, you know, maybe to help us develop our memory, develop our capacity within our brain to a stronger potential. And also, it makes me think of, can the use of this psychedelic or this near-death induction also help with things like Alzheimer's?
Psychedelics or near-death experiences?
Both. Because essentially, remember, we're inducing a near-death experience, right? So, or we're inducing some kind of experience utilizing the psychedelic. So is there a potential to help the brain? And also, can that also have a correlation to potentially treatment of something as really is far distant in terms of finding a cure for something like Alzheimer's?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's studies now for psychedelics for Alzheimer's. So, you know, we'll watch the space. I mean, whether like near-death experiences, I mean, it's a kind of similar thing with what we're saying with the terminal lucidity, right? Someone can have quite advanced Alzheimer's, and then they, before they do actually shuffle off the coil, mm-hmm. they have this sudden lucidity. And that's quite a beautiful thing. Like, you know, it might be some random effect that the brain is trying to preserve itself before this climatic event or whatever, death. But actually it facilitates this quite amazing opportunity for closure with loved ones. And then it can therefore like enable a much easier passing away for the consciousness that is in that organism, you know. And that's just a crazy feature of the universe, like whether or not that was some kind of, maybe is there some evolutionary value in that? I don't know. Is it just this beautiful bug in the system, or it was designed that way? So there's that relationship with Alzheimer's, something kind of similar to near-death experiences. But I don't know if I've read like an account of someone who had Alzheimer's, had a near-death or just dementia, and then had a near-death experience and then came back and it was kind of like cured, because it's not really as simple as that, because it is, it's a lot of like genetic determinism, and it is like a degenerative process. But they may well be helped for some time. And similarly to terminal lucidity stuff, that'd be interesting to see that. I would not be surprised if that has happened several times. But I am very interested in, and again, I've written some grants and stuff for this idea of near-death experiences in psychiatric or neuropsychiatric populations, because
that'd be interesting.
Yeah, I've never seen an account of someone's near-death experience like reflecting whatever mental illness that they had at the time, which could have been quite severe. Like there's interesting anecdotes certainly about the near-death experience, like basically their experience being completely free of whatever mental suffering that they had beforehand, and then to see if that continued afterward. Yeah, and just lastly about this link, I mean, there was a study by Bruce Grayson that there was an outpatient population, psychiatric patients, and
we need psychedelics to help us with our memory.
Yeah, definitely. What was the link that he was looking at? It was really interesting. It was the link between
near-death experience, psychedelics, and the potential of helping.
It was, can't remember.
Terminal
lucidity. Let's just leave that one, unfortunately.
So listen, I want to change it up a little bit, because a lot of people maybe don't realize that you have, obviously you were at Contact in the desert. I don't know what you were lecturing there, saying I wasn't part of it or anything, but is there a correlation to near-death experiences and the use of psychedelics in the UFO, UAP world?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that actually was looked at like in the early 80s, and it's barely been looked at again. But I became really, really interested in that because I was looking at psychedelics and near-death experiences, and in many respects, they actually weren't that similar. But the like alien entity encounter, or like even abduction scenario for some of our participants, and it was much closer, you know, some of our DMT participants. So, but then what about that, the other relationship within that kind of holy or unholy trinity, you know, the near-death and the UFO abduction stuff. And I gave a talk in my hometown of Brighton the other day, which did speak to this a little bit. And I got a couple of, you know, and understandably, because it sort of, for better or worse, was why I was wanting to look more into it, because they were disturbed. And I, you know, as I was, by this relationship, you know, that, you know, because I did like an informal study of, like, dozens of near-death experiences which just looked like abduction experiences. They look the same.
That's what I think. See, I think some near-death experiences, there's a correlation between these experiences and abduction experiences, because when you listen to someone who's been abducted, you're like, well, that sounds like near death. And then near death, you're like, well, that possibly. And the only differentiation that I have is the evidential component.
Yeah, it's hard to find like evidential stuff with the abduction stuff for sure. But, you know, it's just because there's been quite good continued research with near death experiences since like the 60s, and there hasn't been nearly as much with the Dutch stuff, so it could just be an artifact of that. Maybe it is there. I mean, there was one account from Whitley Strieber's book, The Communion Letters.
Yes.
Again, you know, my memory's hazy on this one, but basically he was in a car with his daughter and then, you know, driving on the road at night as a like classic thing, and then the daughter said, "What's that in the sky?" And then this like object like moved toward them, and then he like blacked out and then woke up like through the windscreen, and his daughter was, he like had some communication, something, and then, you know, he asked, where's my daughter? Is she okay? You know, she was fine, but then she communicated to him after that, the people who took her or whatever said that she's not going to live, and she was really sorry, and they were really sorry about that. And then she died later. And then weirdly, someone, a family friend at the funeral, then also said that they had a dream of these weird beings and this guy's daughter, like, descending into their house through the roof, and the daughter imparting some last message, like, you know, saying that she's sorry that she couldn't be with him, you know, her father any longer. No, really, like...
That's fascinating. Yeah,
compelling and crazy experience. But, you know, that in a way, it was very much like this weird anecdote which like melded an individual's death and an abduction, but with a precognitive level to it.
I'm keeping on the subject, but have you watched Resident Alien? I did. You've got to go and watch it. It's hilarious.
It's hilarious. Right? It's supposed to be a comedy.
It's hilarious. No, it's hilarious, right? But there is a serious element to it, because they've obviously studied some UAP, UFO stuff. Some of the stuff that you're talking about is indicative of what the you know, about the abduction and the precognition. It's in, you know, it's a series that you watch. It's absolutely hilarious. Go watch it, because what you're talking about is actually replicated in that show. Right? My wife loves it. I didn't get into it, and then she, you know, she started watching it, and then I was writing away, you know, and then I got hooked on it, and then the writing went, and I just kind of but it's interesting, because there does seem to be this correlation to the near-death experience and UFO abduction experience. Now, and the other thing I'm interested in is some people utilizing psychedelics to have contact. And even in a near-death experience, maybe they don't meet their loved ones, but they meet another intelligence. Have you come across that? Have you come any examples where it's not their loved ones they meet, it's another intelligence through either the psychedelic or just the near-death experience?
Yeah, I mean, with psychedelics, you don't tend to see your loved ones. You can. And if it's in grief context, it's much more likely than maybe there's a bit of priming there.
That's what I think.
But yes, psychedelics always, especially DMT or ayahuasca, it's all these crazy-ass entities, you know. and with... the death experiences, it typically is deceased loved ones, family, friends, or whatever. Like, not just it's more likely to be family and friends or whatever, or human beings. It's like they are loved ones who've died. That is the most common. But then you frequently get...
But I wonder if there's any, you know, I met this reptilian...
What, near death?
I had a near-death experience and met a reptilian alien.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I was alluding to before. I mean, they're usually like these more... You know, they're going to be like... figures which are culturally consistent, and they usually are. You know, if you do have a significant enough religious exposure in your life, or whatever, or belief, then it's usually going to be consistent with that, like prophet or a god or whatever. But not always. And if not consistent, then it's going to be it's less likely to be completely inconsistent. Like if you're a diehard Christian and you're not really going to see Ganesh or something, right? That's not really, I mean, it's interesting when you see those anecdotes and they can't pop up sometimes. But, you know, it's usually going to be something a bit more like universal, like a kind of a being of light, you know, which is an interesting descriptor. You know, it's hard to kind of wrap your head around what that is, is some kind of intelligent sentience, which is like emanating from or like composed of light, and that may be still in some kind of form or maybe completely formless. You know, it's a bit confounding to think about, but it's still very inspiring to think about. But yeah, like, so there was this little study I did, and you know, they met like quite a few of them, weirdly, because they were totally independent people and stuff. And prior to their NDE, they weren't like really into the niche parts of this whole alien scape, you know,
right?
Because I'm more into that as than they may have been prior to their NDE, and I still don't go into all these rabbit holes about the kind of classifications of all these like aliens. Like, that's not really my bag. But they then saw like things which are what I latterly learned was like Arcturians. You know, they're like it's like tall, blue, luminous, like big-eyed beings,
yeah,
which are usually, I don't know, benign. I don't know, but they certainly were benign in these NDEs. And, you know, it's just a striking thing, because like, I can't remember exactly how many, maybe like 20 or something. Like, four of them had very similar, not identical, but like beings like this. But none of them out of the 20 or so were like these really hostile abduction accounts where, you know, these beings are completely indifferent to you, or they're malign and they're like dissecting you, and or there's hybridization.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing like that. You know, it was just, they still were in like a craft. There were these things which you would call an alien, you know, if you had to give it a descriptor, and you were in like a kind of clinical environment. And there was technology that what you were being interfaced with in some way. You know, it's fucking weird. Sorry.
That's all right. You can curse. It's no problem. Listen, the amount of times, you know, because of me being a medium and everything else, that I try to hold back it and it slips. It's like, you know, I'm still an ex-soldier. Mm-hmm. So I still have that about me. So yeah, you're all right. You're all right. Yeah, I find it freaking amazing. I remember many, many years ago, I went to a MUFON conference, and I was asked to go there, and I was meeting some people and people that were having an experience. Now, what I potentially took it down to was a more of an obsession possession experience from another type of intelligence, but not alien, and that what they were experiencing was from a mediumistic point of view. And I mean, that's a whole other bag, but there is so much that we don't understand, and there's so much that I think we can learn, not only from the NDE experience, but utilizing these psychedelics. But the interesting thing is people being primed. I would find it more compelling for someone who didn't really have a religious bias or was interested in hauntings, was interested in it. I once got called out to a haunting, potential haunting, and by a guy that's totally freaking materialistic, totally freaking skeptic. He was like, I guess I don't know what's going on, but I see these things. And turns out it was a spirit from the other side, but he didn't believe in anything. So for me, it's more compelling if nobody believes in the UFOs, but they have an experience, or an abduction experience, and then it changes their ontology, changes everything. You know, the whole worldview changes from these experiences, whether they meet loved ones or whether they meet an alien. How does that shift their whole worldview? Like those people that you did the study on that said they were meeting the Arcturians, what happened after?
Yeah, I wasn't specifically focusing on the after effects actually with that study. In that case, it may be a matter of, you know, who knows. There's a talk, so I was at the Soul Foundation conference the other day in Italy, and Soul Foundation is like this crazy thing where, like, you know, the UFO stuff, or the deeper recesses of it, like, you know, the hybridization program or whatever, you know, finding back engineer craft and bodies in Area 51 and stuff like that.
The paranormal deserves serious conversation, not just speculation. Through Deadly Departed, Paranormal Daily News, and the Parawise Journal, I bring together researchers, investigators, and people who have experienced the unexplained firsthand. Beyond the podcast, there's also a private community where we connect, share experiences, and explore these subjects together. Visit paranormaldailynews.com to learn more, because the conversation about the unknown shouldn't stop when the episode ends.
That that was like tinfoil hat stuff, right, before. And now, if not that specifically, you know, necessarily, it's still the larger UFO phenomenon. Like that now, with, as I see it, like with the Seoul Foundation thing, just in the last 3 years, has almost become like elitist. And it's very similar to what's going on with psychedelics. That was very fringe and stuff. And then now it's like billion-dollar industry, blah, blah, blah. That was interesting itself. But yeah, so I was there and Diana Pasalka was talking, and she is a Catholic theologian, and she's been getting into this field with a couple of books recently. And she was referencing this individual who was the chief historian for NASA. And he was a main like pioneer in developing ideas of what intelligent life in the universe may look like, or where would it come from, or how likely is it if it exists and stuff like that. But he, in his, you know, he kind of concluded that, he concluded things that you wouldn't necessarily have expected, or I don't think NASA would have. I still don't know if, you know, NASA doesn't necessarily endorse it, but his personal conclusion was that it's most likely to be like a post-biological thing, like they've transcended biology, and he refers to like these things as being like non-supernatural gods. And so it's a kind of a opportunity for the naturalization of divinity, and these beings
right.
may have existed and may have developed to such a degree. And then, you know, there may be some allusions and things for the kind of ancient astronaut thing of like, well, that's why we encounter them as deities and treat them as such, because they were tantamount to that if we had any interaction with them. Anyway, I'm going a bit off on a tangent with this, but she was referencing his stuff, and he referred to this idea of a culturally adaptive interface in reference to the way in which these beings may present themselves, because they aren't just limited to physicality. And, you know, I don't know the details of it, how, if he does become so explicit about this thing, but like there's some engagement they can have with consciousness, you know, some way where they can mediate our perception of them, right? And so that's why we might see them in a culturally consistent way. And even Carl Sagan, he was incredibly beyond his time. He was obviously just a visionary when he
was in contact. Yeah.
And he, unfortunately, to spoil the book or the film, and you're mute yourself now if like you don't want to hear it because it's beautiful, but it is visionary, because this person ultimately is given like this blueprint to create this machine that allows them to travel to this extraterrestrial race, but that a kind of, you know, ambassador or whatever of this extraterrestrial race comes to her in the form of her deceased father. So again, that is a really interesting.
It is
overlap already between what we're saying with the alien
phenomena,
but also just generally in terms of how these things may potentially like deliberately.
So they have it's like shapeshifting. They have a choice. They can, if you're a Buddhist, they can appear as a Buddhist. If you're Catholic, they can appear as Mother Mary.
They can interact. Territory, because obviously there's so much psychological, neural, computational, neuroscientific reason stuff that we can be quite clear about how these things can, you know, you can have these perceptions based on just your cultural priors. So your brain is a predictive engine, is going to be able to create a perception which is consistent with what you expect and stuff like that. So it, you know, it's just whether both things are happening at once or not. Yeah, I can't even remember your original question, why I talked about that, about this whole way that they present themselves. It was related to your question.
Yeah, so, I mean, I find it fascinating. So
I'm sorry to cut you off. This is just the last thing I'll say on that. Just so I want to close the loop. It's because you were saying, like, oh, do they have ontological shock after the Arcturian thing?
Yeah.
In NDE? But the thing
what
is,
happens
is that
after?
Our cultural landscape is evolving so much, and our technologization and secularity and stuff. Maybe if they saw Jesus, that's going to be more of an ontological shock. Do you know what I mean? So maybe that's a way that they interface with us, because it's actually less shocking, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah, go for it. Oh, yeah, because only your case. See, I know if I saw Jesus or Mary, if I had an experience, I would accept that. But if I saw, like, a 12-foot freaking alien that looked like a serpent or a snake, it might I would not want to. That would put me into ontological shock. I mean, that's going to be a big no-no. And I'm interested in how people's experiences, whether it be NDE or utilizing these, or even from a UFO point of view, that it can cause them spiritual crisis, or it can change their whole, where, you know, they become more fearful, they go into some kind of negative shock, and even it could cause psychosis. But then maybe, and this is something that leads on to some of the research that we are doing, could become an awakening experience for them, but then you come back to this world. It's like, you know, when I had my near-death experience, you come back to this world and you're like, oh wow, it's a bit of a letdown. When you come, you know, you kind of come back, but it must be terrifying from someone who has this experience, and if it is a negative experience, to come back to this world with what they've experienced, and whether it's a UFO or not. And I 90% of the, I think personally, 90% of these UFO claims are unfounded.
The claims of what are unfounded exactly?
Their abduction experiences are unfounded. I think there's a lot of people that want the experience and can manifest it. They have an interest, they have a bias. I'm more interested in people that are not, have no interest in it at all, and then have these experiences. Like, if you're Catholic and you believe in exorcism and the demons are going to possess you, can become a reality because that. So I'm more somebody who's not Catholic and then has an experience that is, and maybe even in the same as UFO experiences, or in the same as using a psychedelic, has a negative experience, and they're not religious in any way, but then it changed their whole worldview.
Even if, I mean, yeah, the inconsistency is interesting, and you're right, it probably does align with the ontological shock thing. So it's kind of interesting when it's disaligned, like in terms of their background and the content of whatever it is, NDE, psychedelic experience. That's interesting for two reasons, because it's more important for two reasons, because it is an anomaly. So it's like, well, you can't just explain it because of their background. But also it's got clinical implications, because you're right, it probably does align with it being more ontologically shocking for them. So yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember like interesting anecdotes. There's one from his book by Stan Grof, I think it's Beyond the Brain. But it was like an LSD, high-dose LSD experience. This person had an encounter with a particular pig deity. At the time, it was just described in this particular way, you know, this detailed way of this deity based on like, you know, a boar, a pig, you know. And then afterward, you know, they subsequently learned that it was exactly the same as this like very niche deity in this particular religious tradition, whatever it was. So he spoke about that expressly, about it being really weird for that reason. So it does happen, and it happens with DMT experiences a lot, like with Hindu related deities, which maybe now, you know, it's much more common to be familiar with them, but some decades ago less so. You know, where they were told they weren't aware of these particular deities, or they would manifest in their trip in a way which is very similar to subsequent depictions that they would see, you know. Yeah, it can be, the ontological shock is interesting for either of these kinds of experiences, because it doesn't need to be distressing and have this shock value. Like, it can be beautiful, it can be utterly blissful and beatific, and, you know, this kind of transcendent near-death experience, psychedelic experience. But, you know, in their mystical nature, you know, unitivity and transcendence of time, space, and everything, sense of the sacred. And then, you know, like you were kind of alluding to before, like you had your own near-death experiences, or those you speak to, like, they then come back, and it's a very, very grueling experience to like reincorporate into this body and into this, not just this physical world, but the nature of a society where you are special, you know, as blessed as we are in the modern day, in many respects, there are certain dimensions of which they can become very sensitive to, which, you know, maybe darker. And that is real, like, tragedy for them. And they're like endlessly yearning. And so there is this. So it may be shocking, obviously, still in terms of how they may have been a materialist before, but maybe they were, you know, maybe they still actually believed in this stuff, had a consistent background, and it was still this beatific, like, near-death experience, for instance. But because belief and background doesn't hold a candle to the profundity and depth of the experience.
Of the experience.
When you actually have it, they can still have real protracted challenges, like lifelong challenges. And so, yeah, that's just why. And so you can imagine, like, if they have all of that, but then also there's other elements of it, which are a bit more bizarre, whether it's like, you know, this UFO related stuff or not. But there's obviously the need, the increasing need for care of these people, like, to be taken seriously on like an institutional level, so that, you know, they don't lose their minds over this and can actually be, you know, can actually harness this for more like an awakening like trajectory.
You know, it's interesting, there's been examples of mediums who have had experiences and ended up in a psychiatric unit because of the shocking experiences they've had, or the fact that they've opened up so much that they can't switch it off anymore. And I don't want to mention any names, but I'm going back to an example of a particular medium back in South Wales that was well known and ended up in a psychiatric unit getting help. And equally, a schizophrenic patient that I worked with that was really mediumistic, and once that was identified and trained and educated, had no more schizophrenia experiences. They were gone. It's interesting, and that's something as well that you're going to come on my own personal podcast on Pillars of Grief, and we're going to talk more about ontology and ontology of shock and grief and integrating the grief journey and psychedelic and everything else, and mediumship and afterlife and how it all kind of blends in. I'm looking forward to that, because there is definitely, even everything we've spoken to today, there's a potential even in mediumship research and how these experiences could affect the outcome of mediumistic experiences. And that's something I'm interested in, is with my sensitivity of being a medium, should I take something psychedelic? How is that experience going to affect me? Is it going to be wonderful where I open up even more? So for instance, I mean, when I had my experience, my NDE, my ability was a lot stronger after it, much stronger after it, right? So then you think about taking the psychedelic, is that going to strengthen the abilities that I have or the experience? Or is it going to put me in a state of turmoil because the experience may be positive or negative? And I go into ontological shock, but a negative ontological shock. So there's an element there that warrants investigation, is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I've always wanted to do a study on like modern psychedelic mediumship, because this is something which has been done in an indigenous context all the time. Or like syncretic Afro-Caribbean stuff from Brazil, and they take ayahuasca and that's the whole thing, like contact the deceased. Or like spirit guides for psychopompics and stuff and or whatever.
I'm down for that.
Yeah. So, you know, I just wonder if people would do that in other non-Indigenous contexts that they take to connect with.
Yeah.
Are they like formal mediums in that way, like other mediums, but they have, that's their tool of getting into that kind of trance or what, you know, and or specific directionality there, like were they mediums and then they took psychedelics, or they took psychedelics and they had these psychic openings, which does frequently happen.
Awakening, like, yeah.
Experiences afterward as well. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see what your thing is. I mean, that could be an interesting thing for you to look into. You know, that exact field.
It is something I am interested in. It's something I might, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to take any compound that was chemically made, rather more a natural, like mushroom or something like that, you know, and then maybe see what happens after, you know, in terms of any sittings or readings I do or my experience and noting that experience down.
I would say that, because obviously there are different types of mediums, right? Like, and some are more, and there's a kind of a spectrum of trance, right? So if you're, I don't know what kind of medium you are, but if you're more one of those ones which do enter into a cue, like, or to stay in order to connect, then if you're already acquainted with navigating these kinds of significant shifts in consciousness, then, you know, you're obviously very well placed to do that, much more than many other people who don't have any kind of training or familiarity with the altered states at all.
And yes, I am. That's what's interesting me. And of course, I have a big, in terms of trans mediumship, I have my own feelings of trans mediumship. A lot of what I see or what is claimed as trans mediumship is not trans, because they're not really in a deep altered state. Mm. It's more, you know, in like we would do when we had our own church, our own spiritualist church, myself, my wife, and we demonstrated in other churches, you would go up in the pulpit, or I would go up in the pulpit, and it would be inspirational. And we were in trance, it would just be inspirational speaking, where you would open up and you would allow spirit to come through, and you would just inspirationally teach from that point. And I think that's what a lot of people are thinking is trance mediumship, because when you see real trance, you experience it. It's different. The medium is down. There is no, I'm going to say there's no consciousness. They're not there. There's evidence as well. And they don't remember anything. You know, when you experience, I'm not going into any seances, real kind of trance mediumship is very unique. And I think if you get that ability and you can marry that with the potential of psychedelic, there's a potential there for real research on another dimension, really. That interests me. Maybe that's something in the future. That's something maybe we can do together again at some point after this next one. Pascal, it has been brilliant. I'm noting that we've gone on way over, and I'm mindful of your time as well. And I'd love to have you back and we chat more about these things. You're going to be a guest with me on Pillars of Grief as we go in more into the afterlife and mediumship and our research, because we're doing some really unique research together as well on psychedelic ontological shock and spiritual awakening, the grief journey, the experiences through grief, and I'm really excited about that. We're working on that just now, and so we'll dive in more into that, into Pillars of Grief, let people know how they can get involved with us. I always like to ask everybody at the end of the show, from your research and from your own experiences, what is one lesson that you can give to humanity now that you would say, from your research, from experience, what's the lesson that you wished you knew back then, back in the day, that you could teach now?
Trying to think of the right way to formulate this. Don't lose. I'm really, because this is a very important message, actually. So I'm glad you did ask, but so just because of its importance, I'm just trying to think of the best way to formulate it. But
that's all right. Take your time. It's we'll edit the spaces out anyway, so it won't sound like you're waiting any time. I've got a great editor.
Okay, good. You can. I still don't. Okay, well, glad you got an editor, because I'm just gonna just fail, fumble around now trying to say the most succinct way of getting this across. But don't get into all of this stuff if you don't have to, basically. Because it's too late for me. Like, glimpsed already, behind
Wait, why is it too late for you?
Just because I'm deep in the research and I can't unknow the things that I know, or I can't, like, unthink the things that I think about. Because it can be quite ontologically challenging in terms of what we're talking about, right? So you don't just need to have these experiences. It's just a matter of engaging with it at all. That can affect and potentially, like, disrupt your oven, like, relationship with this world. And the thing is like, this world is like that which is immediately imminent. Like, that is the only thing that you can truly know.
Yeah.
Anything else is it then edges more into the realm of pontification or fantasy or whatever, can be better or worse. And it's just a message of recommending a level of discernment and groundedness. And that, if you take it from someone like me that's gone into this, it's not necessary. You can live a full life. You can live like life to the full, you can still be in awe of the way that the world just immediately presents itself to you in all of its glorious materiality, and you can accept that which is quote unquote trivial. If you, or in light of it being in actuality, like really anything but mundane, it's, maybe the most pithy thing that I could have said is like the most cliche Hallmark card thing ever, which is like, life is the trip.
Yeah. And
you realize that when you come out of life, when you, for instance, that could be anything, but especially with psychedelic experiences, you come back and you realize that actually it's this entire world which is inexplicable and miraculous. It's easy, it's similarly like it's easier for me to say that, having had psychedelic experiences or having gone down this like research rabbit hole and stuff, and then coming back, and then it's maybe a bit like not hypocritical, but inconsistent for me to then say to people that they don't need that and just take my word for it. You know, life's amazing. You don't need to like, you know, potentially lose yourself in all of this further fringes of reality and experience. But maybe it's still an important thing to hear.
Absolutely. I also think it's even these experiences can be great teachers for us. As I've always said, that grief can be your greatest nemesis or your greatest teacher. It's up to you how you approach it. And what you're saying also reminds me of like Sir Marjorie Woolcott, who literally changed her whole... She went, I mean, talking about ontological shock, her whole worldview changed, everything changed. And she was like you, she was a neuroscientist and so steeped in it. And I, you know, Marjorie and I had a great conversation before all about that and how she changed her things. And then one of my other, who I've had, I can't remember her name now, she's great, Dr. Lisa Miller, I love her, she's great. I mean, she really had, and her ontology changed totally from, and she was, you know, neuroscientific, and her experiences went beyond the science, and then it totally changed her worldview. So yeah, you don't have to experience it, but when you do, it can be a dramatic awakening experience. And that's obviously what some of the research that we're doing as well, which I'm excited about. Pascal, I've thoroughly enjoyed that. And if anybody's listening, by the way, Pascal's got a great voice. He's a great singer. I've checked him out because, yeah, I mean, I've done singing in the past of that. But anybody who's listening this in a musical, I can see him in Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, and singing. Although there's a few notes in there that are,
yeah,
their octave is freaking high.
Might need to drop a key if any of you are going to employ me for jazz.
Not half. Yeah. Go check his channel out and listen to him singing. He's done a little good skit as well before, which I watched last night before during lockdown. And that was quite interesting. I'm listening to him. I was like, oh, he's got a good control of that voice there.
Thank you.
Going from my own singing back. Who knows? You might get at some point, we'll have an event and maybe I'll be singing with Pascal on stage.
That'd be cool. I would actually love
it. That would not be too far from the truth. The big PDN event, that's what we're going to do, ladies and gentlemen. The big PDN event that we have, because PDN is quite substantial, we're working on putting a big event together. Pascal will come over and then we'll have a little bit of a sing-song.
Yeah,
that's definitely, because I love, like, I can see Les Miserables as well. I can see us doing Julen with, you know,
Duet.
Being Javert, and yeah.
And Jean Valjean, Shotgun Javert.
Yeah. Jean Valjean from Les Mis. Beautiful. You're going to be back on. Pascal's also going to be doing, that you probably don't know that we've spoke about, but I'm going to force him to do it because this is fascinating stuff. And courses and all sorts, and get more involved. Pascal is also one of our new editors in the Parawise Journal, which is launched, and we're developing now. We're looking for a first edition coming out in December. So look out for that and join us on Pillars of Grief. We'll let you know. This is the Day of the Dead. Remember your loved ones. Remember your experiences. This has been a fantastic, longest episode I've ever done on Deadly Departed, but absolutely fantastic. And guys, ask any questions. You know the drill. Send them in. Join our private community, Paranews Network, and we'll have him back, because there's so much to unpack that we haven't even covered. We could go deeper and deeper and deeper in all sorts of ways. Pascal, brother, thank you for joining me today. This has been phenomenal.
Yeah, no problem. It's been really, really, really fun, Jock. Thanks so much. Look forward to it.
Awesome. If you are enjoying this episode of Deadly Departed, then please share it with your colleagues or share it with your friends. And if you've got any ideas on anyone that you would like us to invite onto the podcast for an interview, then please let us know. Once again, thank you for joining us today. And please remember and subscribe. God bless.